Yeah, that you do have people call themselves tax planners.
I'm sure
is that an investment individual who shows you how to invest your money in investments that keep you from paying a bundle of taxes? Is that the same thing as a tax consultant?
I'm sure that a lot of tax consultants are engaged in tax planning, as are accountants and attorneys and enrolled
agents. So you make no distinction between the two?
We're not very good.
I don't know if someone would be engaged in tax planning and not be involved in preparing returns, and perhaps someone from the profession could more clearly answer that.
Is there any further questions? Thank you very much. Ivan Hoyer? Okay, Eleanor Blundell, would you like to join Mr. Hoyer at the... Mr. Hoyer, if you'd identify yourself, then give us your testimony, please.
My name is Ivan Hoyer. I'm Vice Chairman of the Oregon State Board of Tax Service Examiners. I'm from Cottage Grove. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am spokesman for the board for House Bill 2093, which is specifically related to the continuance of the State Board of Tax Service Examiners, as recommended by the 61st Oregon Legislative Sunset Review Committee. It's been difficult for me to adequately organize this information because, like everything, it's a forest for the trees. You're pretty close to the operation, but we'll try to do so in a manner favorable to your liking. It is interesting to note that the commercial preparation of income tax return has been done far longer in Oregon than most people realize, becoming particularly important as a profession since the conclusion of World War II. During the years following the war, only licensing agencies in the state of Oregon was by the State Board of Accountancy. In 1953, the Oregon legislature created a new tier of licensing administered by the State Board of Accountancy, with the licensees called public accountants. In 1973, the Oregon legislature established the Oregon State Board of Tax Service Examiners, which was charged with examining, licensing, and the continuing regulation of those individuals preparing personal income tax returns for the public for a fee. A strong classroom and continuing education program was authorized and implemented by 12 out of the 13 community colleges within the state of Oregon. These colleges offer student courses in tax preparation using instructional manuals prepared by qualified practitioners under the sponsorship of the State Department of Education and the approval of the Board of Tax Service Examiners. The two state associations have developed continuing education programs along with numerous private sponsors, and continuing tax education, which was practically non-existent in the outlying areas prior to the licensing requirement, is now made available. In 1982, the provisions of the Oregon Sunset Review Act caused the State Board of Tax Service Examiners to come under the scrutiny of the Oregon Legislative Sunset Review Committee. As a result of this examination, the Sunset Review Committee framed House Bill 2093 that we're discussing today. Harking back slightly, since 1973, the number of tax returns prepared in the state of Oregon by all licensed practitioners has appreciably increased. The Oregon Department of Revenue indicates that more than 64% of all tax returns filed have been prepared by more than one of the licensed groups. This means that over 750,000 personal returns were prepared by trained licensees in Oregon during the last filing season, many of these licensed by the State Board of Tax Service Examiners. The expertise of the licensees regulated by the Oregon Board of Tax Service Examiners has become more important when we realize that the Internal Revenue Service has begun to phase out its taxpayer assistance program, and this has now almost been completely discontinued. The Oregon Department of Revenue has reduced its taxpayer service program as well. Thus, the importance of knowledgeable, trained, and disciplined tax preparers has become more important as the years progress. Question is, just how well prepared are the licensed tax preparers in Oregon? I can answer this by stating that there was a popular assumption in the mid-1970s that only certified accountants and tax attorneys were capable of preparing adequate income tax returns. A study conducted by the General Accounting Office of the United States government revealed that returns prepared by commercial preparers and by attorneys and CPAs and PAs as well, all over the nation, were about equal in the number of errors occurring in computing tax liabilities. The study also found that errors made by the commercial preparers, as compared to the certified preparers, appeared on the returns in generally the same places and were often made for the same reasons. Regardless of the information revealed by the study made by the GAO, Congress passed the Preparers Penalty Act of 1976, establishing certain federal requirements regarding the preparation of income tax returns and applying them to all income practitioners in the United States. That includes all licensed categories. In the meantime, the Oregon State Board of Tax Service Examiners has been flexing its own muscles, supervising commercial preparers in the state of Oregon. Its objective was to provide relief for the taxpayers from unscrupulous practitioners, establish educational criteria to raise the level of knowledge and ability of practitioners, and to provide a source of relief from indiscriminate practice of certain elements of the profession. As can be shown by statistics accumulated since the licensing laws come into being, the board has received a total of over 1,001 consumer complaints. Between 1973 and 1975, the board received only 84 consumer complaints. In the next 2 years, the number rose to 225, topping out in the biennium of 1977 through 1979, and has declined appreciably from those years, as the effect of the disciplinary action of the board has taken effect upon the practitioners in protecting the interests of the Oregon taxpaying consumer. Of those 1,000-plus complaints to the board, letters of warning to licensees and non-licensees alike totaled 363. There have been 31 letters of reprimand issued by the board. More severely, 57 civil penalties have been assessed, resulting in fines totaling $18,950. Six licensees have been denied through the board's pre-licensing screening process. Nine licenses have been suspended, and seven have been revoked. Administrative hearings have been conducted for 33 of these cases. Some action beneficial to the consumer has been taken by the board or its administrative and investigative staff in each one of these more than 1,000 complaints made by the public. It is the belief of the board that even though perfection in action is sought, it is not always achieved. We hope that fairness, compassion, and considered evaluation of all information provided the board has led to equitable decisions in the majority of those complaints that have been heard. In some quarters, it has been stated that the licensing law came into being simply to legislatively place a stamp of professionalism on the business of preparing tax returns. And that complaint exists today. That also, the licensing law would promote a closed shop situation for those practitioners already in business. It has been my knowledge that all the licensing law may have helped enhance the appearance of tax preparers to the public. The profession itself had already achieved some semblance of a status in the eyes of the public long before the licensing law came into being by being acceptable. It has also shown that far from fostering a closed shop, the business climate in Oregon, as was once a concern, quite the contrary has occurred, in that properly educated and tested practitioners are entering the field in increasing numbers year after year. Today, there are nearly 3,850 licensed tax consultants and preparers in the state of Oregon, as against 1,921 licensed during the first year of the law.
Excuse me one second. I'm going to have to leave the committee hearing for a short time. Before I leave, I want to ask you a question. In your testimony, you said that the Penalty Act of 76 establishes certain federal requirements. That's only dealing with federal taxes now. That act does not cover anything to do with state taxes.
It has nothing to do with the Oregon law.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I apologize, but something I have to do.
Okay. Please proceed.
I believe it is reasonable to state that the increasing complexity of the federal and state of Oregon income tax laws are creating a situation whereby even some of the more simple returns may run afoul of the prolific number of the rules and regulations imposed by government agencies to collect more and more taxes. In the future, many more returns will be prepared by licensed tax consultants and preparers They're striving even now to keep abreast of the increasing volume of tax law legislation being rained upon us all, almost on a daily basis. And we do this through education and by developing an adequate tax library. The Internal Revenue Service has also attempted to evaluate the performance of tax preparers in Oregon. A study prepared under the supervision of the Internal Revenue Service and submitted to the Oregon Sunset Review Committee on October 12, 1982, reveals that of all the third-party prepared returns, those prepared by Oregon practitioners averaged an accuracy rating of 97.25%. Those prepared by taxpayers themselves achieved an accuracy rate of only 85.6%. In addition to these statistics, Mr. Jerry Huntley, field representative for the board, is furnished with a list of assessments made against Oregon tax practitioners by the Internal Revenue Service under the provisions of the Preparers Penalty Act of 1976. Mr. Huntley receives a copy similar to that received by the tax practitioner, noting the type of assessment. Mr. Huntley has informed the members of the board that roughly 90% of the penalties assessed against Oregon licensed tax practitioners are for failure to sign the returns or place their federal identification number on the return. Only 10% of the penalties assessed fell into the category of intentional disregard of the rules and regulations. These are just a few of the yardsticks that have been used in determining the effectiveness of the rules and of conduct and regulations of practice implemented by the Board of Tax Service Examiners. In fact, the Tax Service Examiners' Law is proven to be effective enough in practice within the state of Oregon to cause the state of California to rescind their old practitioner's registration law and pass a more stringent preparer regulatory act. The state of Washington is presently considering an act very similar to that in existence in the state of Oregon. The board has been concerned throughout its existence with the matter of consumer awareness of the activities of the board. Its licensees and the ability of the board to function on behalf of the taxpayer. During the past 10 years, publicity has been disseminated to the people through news releases, through the media, by direct contact with the two estate associations, and through the board's own publications. It is unfortunate, however, that the board has twice applied for funds in its biennial request as presented to the Oregon legislature, which would have promoted in-depth public awareness information, and in both cases, the funds have been denied. Probably the greatest amount of information pertaining to the board has reached the public through the direct contract by its nearly 3,900 licensees who work directly with the taxpayer by whom he or she is employed. The biennial budget for the operation of the board is nominal, reasonable, and administered with the frugality generally reserved for a family budget. The overall expenditure limitation of the Board of Tax Service Examiners for the biennium of 1983-85, as recommended by the Ways and Means Committee, is $368,363, all of which will be funded from fees received from examinees and licensees. Significantly, Oregon tax preparers are individuals who have been educated, trained, and disciplined in the preparation of personal income tax laws promulgated by both the federal government and the state of Oregon, particularly since the state of Oregon has disengaged from the federal tax code. All licensees are required to obtain a minimum of 20 hours of continuing education each year to enable them to retain their license. The majority of these licensees continually submit educational certificates far exceeding the minimum requirements. As a representative of the Board of Tax Service Examiners, I have been instructed to respectfully petition this committee for its approval to continue the Board of Tax Service Examiners and allow it to serve the Oregon public by having passed into law House Bill 2093 as it has been presented to you for enactment, except for one portion of the proposed act. It has been suggested through wording contained in line 21 of section 4, item 3, subparagraph B, that, quote, the requirement of higher standards of knowledge of tax law, theory, and practice, and includes, quote, tax planning, unquote. It is the opinion of the board that the words tax planning have not been defined at all, and these two words are such a broad nature as to cause immediate confusion and uncertainty as to its application under the law. We believe the words tax planning should be stricken from the bill and reserved until such time as criteria for tax planning can be established and defined adequately outlined to effectively inform the tax practitioner exactly what is meant and how it is to be employed by the licensee in relation to his own consumer and client. This can be done only by the board taking time in the future to develop and present a proposal regarding tax planning activities for presentation to a future session of the legislature for your consideration. Other amendments to the present law included in House Bill 2093 are with the concurrence of the Tax Board, and for your convenience, a summary of these amendments has been prepared and presented to you as Exhibit 1. If the committee has any questions, either the Board Administrator, Eleanor Blundell, beside me, or I will attempt to answer them for them. Thank you very much.
Any questions, committee members? Mr. Hoyer, I'll ask you a question. Why does a tax consultant need to know, or why does he not need to know about tax planning?
Why does he need to know about tax planning?
Well, why is it not necessary? Either way you want to answer it.
Mr. Vice Chairman and members of the committee, tax planning is just one part of your tax law. Over the years, particularly on the federal level, and as Oregon has several years ago agreed to accept the federal code as the tax code of the state of Oregon, this is generally still applied. Tax planning becomes when the federal code in itself has provided relief through the way the laws are written to save taxes through implementation of any one of several forms of the law. And tax planning is simply the matter of advising your client how to take advantage of this, or to take advantage of it, as the case may be. I differentiate this from a field that is actually today called financial planning, which does assume some proportion of the tax planning field in itself. But this gets into the matter of exactly how to invest your funds or not to invest your funds in achieving this this goal. We don't get into that, in my opinion. We simply advise the consumer on what is available to them, and they can accept this or reject it as they see fit. Tax planning is still a field that, as I've mentioned in my comments, not very adequately defined.
Can I assume from your comments that most tax consultants do not engage in tax planning very heavily beyond explaining some segments of the law, perhaps, as compared to perhaps a lawyer or a CPA who would perhaps advertise this and actively engage in it?
I'd say that would be reasonably true, yes.
Any other questions? Okay, Eleanor, do you have something to add?
No, I think that Mr. Hoyer has, for the record, my name is Eleanor Blundell. I'm the administrator for the board. We did submit...
Excuse me, Eleanor, would you pull a microphone over in front of me, please?
We did submit Exhibit 1 to Mr. Hoyer's presentation, which gives you a brief outline of the amendments that the board would be is in favor of seeing included in the bill, and I think that these have already been gone over by Bob Grunstad, so I don't think I have anything further to add unless you have some questions.
Question for either one of you. Ivan has just suggested that the bill be amended by deleting the word tax planning. And it looks like Exhibit 1 really talks about the bill itself. Does Exhibit 1 also refer to the tax planning portion, the new amendment?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman. Let's see, did I include this one? It's item number 3 on page 1.
Well, okay. I think that includes the provision in the bill as it was drafted.
That's correct.
Well, do you concur with Mr. Hoyer's recommendation that the tax planning portion be deleted as an amendment to the bill?
Yes, Mr. Vice Chairman, I do.
You do? Okay.
You asked me if I had anything else to add, and I did want to add that I think a question was asked earlier if the civil penalties that are collected by any of the other boards go to the boards to carry out their civil penalty provisions. And I believe the architects and the engineers both have that included in their statute, as well as the Board of Accountancy.
It's not fair to ask, and you don't have to answer, but you can if you'd like. Do you think there's any chance that since the fines or the penalties would provide your operating monies that you might be inclined to be a little bit more liberal with them? You don't have to answer that.
Mr. Vice Chairman, we might be able to collect a few more of them if we knew that they were going to go to our fund. We don't. I would say we collect about 65% of them, because we don't have the time to pursue the individuals that have incurred the civil penalties. We do have a provision that we can file a lien on their property, and we do that, and we also turn it over to the Department of Revenue, to their collections division. And those are the actions that we take to collect our civil penalties.
Can you not threaten them with a revocation of license?
We can, if a provision in this bill is passed, then we will be able to. Mm-hmm.
So that you could collect the fines on, or the penalties in that case by, well, a stronger collection effort.
That's correct. If the fine were against a licensee, oftentimes it's against a non-licensee.
What do you do in a case like that where it's a non-licensee and they're practicing?
We can file a lien if they own property in the county where they reside, or we can turn it over to the Department of Revenue, to their collections division.
How do you get them to stop practicing?
We can also file an injunction if we have evidence that they are continuing after we have assessed the civil penalty.
And do you have a problem with that, or are there problems with that?
We have filed an injunction against a person who has been preparing tax returns since our licensing law was passed, and he's over in the Bend area. We have reasons to believe that he perhaps is still preparing returns, but we don't have any evidence of it. And we, in order to carry on, to go back to the court, we have to have evidence that he is continuing to practice.
Any other questions, members?
Mr.
Vice
Chairman, I would like to have one clarification, please.
Yes.
Mr. Hoyer, comments have been made from time to time concerning the fact that other states either do or do not have a law such as this in existence. And I think it's become fairly clear, it's a matter of speculation to a degree, but I can recall personally several years ago that representatives from this state went to Washington, D.C. and discussed this matter with federal officials. And it was placed off of the record with them at that time that eventually either the states accept the voluntary mandate to establish laws of this nature, or the federal government shall attempt to do so in their own right. It's a matter of time, I think, until the state is regulated by either themselves or by the federal government, because of the the increasing complexity of the law and the fact that they change it almost annually now. If we recall that the law was changed in 1939, they waited again until 1954. I'm talking about the federal government, and then 1960s, and then in the 1970s came that deluge of law changes that we see today. It's almost impossible to keep up with it without adequate training and experience in the field as the laws are today.
Thank you, Mr. Hoyer. Ms. Blundell.
I have a question.
Oh, okay. All right. Representative Otto.
If I go to a tax preparer, licensed tax preparer, and they make a gross error in my income tax that I have to pay to the state or federal government, what recourse do I have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otto, if an error occurs on a tax return, I think it's prepared by anyone. That should be drawn to, or is drawn to, the attention of the preparer. The preparer should be allowed the opportunity to repair the damage that has existed. And it's a matter of ethical and moral standard that even though the error has occurred, you'll have to admit this. That's far better than trying to cover it up. And I'm sure that, unfortunately, there are those who do. But the penalties and interest accrued for that error should be paid by the preparer. And, of course, the tax is a problem of the taxpayer himself. If the infractions of the administration of the law, which we call negligence, are severe enough, then the matter can be brought before the board in the case of a licensed tax consultant or preparer, and we can review that matter then and determine whether the person is really competent to prepare a return or not.
All right. You said the tax preparer that made this gross error in my income tax should be morally and ethically responsible for the penalties and the accrued interest.
Yes, sir.
The language was should. Now, there's nothing in the present law, the way I read it, that would make that person liable. And the only recourse I would have would be to go to the court. Is that correct?
That is true.
You think that a provision like that should be included in this law? And I guess then the next follow-up question, if the answer is yes, how do we accomplish that? By having people bonded or what?
Personally, I feel that perhaps it should. In the case of myself, and I'm sure of many other preparers, if we make an error, we just take it for a matter of course that we pay the piper. That's just a case of doing business and maintaining good public relations with your client. They're buying your services, and if you're not displaying that properly, then you should pay the penalty. Bonding may be the answer to making sure that a person is paying the piper, so to speak.
Well, bonding for the licensed professions is not unusual. We go ahead and with the builder's board, we require contractors to be bonded and all. So that at least the customer has some recourse to get back some of the dollars.
And they should.
Okay. Representative Gilmer?
I would. Representative Otto was reading my mind, the questions he asked.
Okay, any other questions? Thank you very much. Ralph Short?
You want to join me in drafting, having language drafted for?
Identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairperson?
Before he starts.
Just a minute, Ralph.
All right.
Yes, Representative Campbell?
I have no idea what the limited liability would be, or the liability would be in a case of that kind of tax. I'm wondering, though, if there isn't a better way to do it than bonding. Bonding is an expense of doing business that I don't think is very attractive, particularly if the losses are at a relatively small nature. And maybe there's a way of doing what you're after that would keep us out of the bonding area. I don't know.
Well, may I?
I agree with your direction, but
I don't care what form it takes. I think that before we look at amendments or anything, we should try and get some figures from the department to see what kind of complaints, the nature of the complaints, and see maybe even investigate with Department of Revenue to get their track record.
Well, we might also, Mr. Chairman, get some information from the folks who are going to be operating under this law,
right,
in addition, is to have them take a look at it. Because as I understand it, most of the legitimate tax preparers already have this. In fact, I would guess that some of them are already carrying insurance to protect themselves. And it would seem to me that we ought to take a look at what they're presently doing. What you're after is to take care of the illegitimate that's probably an improper statement.
I think it is. I think it should be better language. I would agree.
Let me put it this way: we don't want to penalize the legitimate operators.
Eleanor, would you check with Representative Otto after the hearing to see what kind of help he needs, what information he needs, please? Thank you. Okay, Ralph, you're on.
Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee, my name is Ralph Short. I am appearing as a registered lobbyist for the Tax Practitioners Political Action Committee, which was formed in late 1982 to support the continuation of the Oregon State Board of Tax Service Examiners and the licensing of tax consultants and return preparers. I am a retired federal employee. When I retired in January 1981, I had served the federal government for 40 years, 35 of which were with the Internal Revenue Service. Since August of 1971, I was district director of the Portland IRS district, which covers the state of Oregon. Relatively early in my tenure as district director, I was contacted by representatives of a tax practitioner group requesting the assistance of the Internal Revenue Service in designing a training program to enhance the skills of the individual members in the preparation of